Hello again, and welcome everybody to another rowing chat. This is getting to be a really fantastic group of people, so thank you and welcome to everybody who's online at the moment. We're really, really pleased to have you with us. Just before we start, I'd love to hear where you are listening from. So if you've got an account and can add it to the chat, tell us what town or city you're in, just out of curiosity. Now, for anybody who hasn't yet found the archive of Rowing Chat recordings, we have created an account at a website called soundcloud.com. And there you can go and see all of the public recordings for the event that we've hosted. And you can download them for free and listen to them in your own time. Hello, Tact Factory from San Francisco, Chris from London, Graham from Edinburgh, welcome. Very good to have you all with us. Now, our guest this week is Ben Hunt Davis, and I'm going to ask you, Ben, to join in and tell us who are you and what do you do?
Hello, everybody. Yes, my name's Ben Hunt Davis. I've got my own business doing corporate development. The business is called Will It Make the Boat Go Faster? Based, kind of taking the name from my book. And I work with large blue chip organizations through to small entrepreneurial startups, trying to help people focus on what's important, do the right stuff, and get help doing it, essentially. And I also, at the moment, I'm chairman of the organizing committee of the World Cup that's happening in Dorney in June. And if any of you are around and want tickets for the Saturday, please come and get them.
That's great. Right, Ben, let's kick off. What's your favorite rowing boat class?
Well, a mixture, really. I always spent from beginning of September through to Christmas, essentially, in a single scull, which I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed the freedom to do what I want. I didn't have to worry about other people. I could, you know, experiment. I could do everything I wanted. And I really, really enjoyed that part of the year. But I sure as hell wouldn't want to spend the whole season in a single. I think I'd get really bored. So going into an eight, which is it's hard work. The number of different personalities, the faffing of waiting for people to turn up, there's so much stuff that makes it much, much harder, but the camaraderie you get, the piss take, the everything that goes with it, and the sense of speed when you're going well. So I've really enjoyed both boats. Which is my favourite? I'm not sure. Depends on the time of the year.
Thinking back to year 2000, your big year when you won Olympic gold medal. If you could go back before that, what one thing would you have changed and do differently? And on reflection after the Olympics, what would you change about your preparation?
There's loads of stuff we could have done better. As we were going through the process, we kept thinking, oh, if only we had done that. And some stuff we could change if we went along the way. Other stuff, by the time we worked out what we should have done, that time was passed and we're on to different things. There are some, you know, nutrition is in general is something that we could have done much, much better. We worked a bit on nutrition, but that's a whole area we could have done far, far better than we did, I think. And then, you know, lots of small things. The way we approached Henley Royal Regatta in 2000 was rubbish, and I really wish we had have done that differently. I would have loved to have won something at Henley. So there were lots and lots of things we could have and should have changed.
Tell us a little bit more about the Henley experience.
Well, we'd raced two weeks before, I think it was, at Vienna Regatta at the World Cup, where we won, and it was the first World Cup event I'd ever won, the first international thing I'd ever won in an eight, and we beat the Aussies by half a length, and we turned up at Henley thinking, you know, we've got this, we know what we're doing, we're sorted out, and we didn't find a rhythm, we were completely inconsistent, and we were rubbish, and we should have actually having gone fast in Vienna, we should have come back and just started again from scratch, started again with the basics, and built everything up towards the next event, as we'd been doing previously. Suddenly, we thought we were fast, and we got all complicated. And that was a real shame.
Very interesting insights. What would be the three most important lessons you'd recommend for a young athlete or someone new to the sport?
I think enjoying what you're doing, I think, is really, really important. If you're new to the sport and you don't enjoy it, then you're not going to carry on for very long. Making sure it's fun, I think, is really, really important when you start. I think something else, which maybe seems a bit more advanced, but I think is, if you can get into a habit early, is really good. Getting to the habit of properly reviewing what you're doing. So coming away from sessions and working out exactly what you did well, or you know, what you enjoyed, or you know, whatever it is, but getting into a proper good habit of reviewing, rather than, I think, the kind of the classic rowing thing where you come off the water and you go, oh, that was all right, and then you kind of go and get changed. Reviewing stuff properly so you can do things better next time, I think, is really good. And then learning about bounce back ability. But being able to, we all have, you know, sessions, weeks, months, races where things don't go according to plan and we're, you know, fed up. And being able to bounce back from that, being able to get up, dust yourself off and keep going is a really, really important skill to have.
I think that's a life skill as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
In the boat, what do you find to be the key technique that can give extra boat speed?
I think this depends on kind of what level you are on all sorts of different things, really. But the things I thought about with this were being able to suspend your weight between the handle and your feet. If you can use your body weight to move the boat rather than just your muscle power, then you're going to make life a bit easier for yourself. So I think that's a pretty key thing. And Harry Mann was interesting when he was kind of helping coach us. It was easy to start to think that Harry was, you know, he was just into technique. And the only reason he was into technique was so you could move the boat faster, so you could apply more power, essentially. And suspending your weight from the handle is critical in that. Another key thing, I think, is making sure you've got the right hand speed around the back so that you can generate the right rhythm so that the boat can work for you, so that it's more sustainable. I think those are the two key things I'd really talk about, weight off the handle and speed of hands.
Certainly rhythm is a theme that comes through very strongly in your consciousness of your own rowing. One of the things that I've always found is that it's quite important to teach a crew that they make the rhythm. It's not something fleeting and magical that sometimes there and sometimes isn't.
Yeah, absolutely. And frankly, it's something that I was never really that good at. I think I could row by numbers pretty well, but when it came to being rhythmical and moving with the boat, it wasn't. You know, it's a bit like when I'm on a dance floor, completely no rhythm. I think it's really, really important to get right. It's so important, and we, the rowers, have got to generate the rhythm that we want, rather than the boat and the water dictating it to us.
I remember one time watching a Canadian aide who came over to do a pre-match boat race fixture. And watching them just doing steady state paddling down the tideway, they move their hands around the finish at a very fast speed, which would appear to be about the speed you'd do if you were at race pace. And it crossed my mind, and in talking to the other people who saw it, that possibly Spracklin was coaching them all the time to move their hands in the rhythm that they were going to need when they were racing, even when they were actually paddling at about 20.
Yeah, and I think one of the challenges is very often that, you know, we don't do very much stuff, or a lot of people don't do very much stuff at race pace. So you get used to slow movement. And then when you get up to you know, 30s, 40s racing, you're just not used to that speed. So, and as that, the being able to get your hands away and over your knees quickly is absolutely critical. Practicing it when you're at a lower rate makes perfect sense. And I think also one of the things about it, if you want to make a change, really kind of doubling it, really going for it, rather than trying to make small incremental changes, sometimes trying to make a massive change and then you can come back to what's sensible, I think is a good practice as well.
Yeah, exaggerating your movement. Ben, when a crew rows well together and they're already fit, what can you do to make the boat go faster?
You can do a bit of everything. You know, how well together, how fit. If a crew was to row 1% better together, would they go faster? And every single crew in the world, maybe with the exception of the Kiwi pair, can row 1% better together. Every single crew in the world could be 1% fitter. If a crew managed to suspend their weight 1% better, would they go faster? Yeah, I reckon. If they were to, if you do kind of pyrometrics or box jumps or whatever, if you were to do them 1% quieter, which means you've got more coordination when you change direction on your feet, would that make the boat go faster? I reckon so. I think there are so many different 1%ers you could look for that would give you more boat speed. Now, hanging your weight off the handle better by 1% is more likely to give you a better return than making sure your grip on the handle is exactly the right width or something. That may, you know, that'll make a difference, but probably less of a difference. But essentially, there are loads and loads and loads of things that can help a crew go faster, no matter how fit or strong they are, technically good they are.
So bearing in mind that most of our audience here are coaches and rowers who row at clubs rather than internationally, what sort of an approach do you think they should be taking to this 1% rule that you've articulated?
There are a few ways of doing it. You can either start from, you know, think about what are our strengths, how can we play to our strengths more. If we think we've got really good catch, then, you know, can we improve that by 1%, or do we start from our weaknesses? And it, you know, a bit of both. And I think really making whatever part of the stroke, making it a real, real point of focus and spending a few sessions, and whether that be on the water, on a rowing machine, in the gym, think about how does that one thing affect what you're doing in all these different things. So I mentioned box jumps earlier. We were really keen to get the change in direction on our feet better. Mm-hmm. So when we were doing box jumps, they had to be silent because that showed coordination. When we were walking up and down stairs, it had to be silent because it was all about coordinating your movement on your feet. And you know, with the rowing stroke, you can take any part of it. And which part you choose to start with, I'm not sure. I mean, it'll be different for each crew. But they're all there to take.
I like that. And I certainly think that the 1% rule is something we could all take away from your talk today and apply to our own coaching and our own crews. Just going to track back to the hand speed round the finish. We've got a question from a viewer, Chris, who says the Australian pair of Drew and Jin were very slow around the back doing UT2 based on video. Should we therefore ignore the guidance of going out from the finish as fast as your hand speed goes in?
And I think, Drew, there's a film, I think, of Drew that he posted a few months ago where he kind of disputes that point. About how fast you should be going away. If you watch I remember at the World Championships in 99, we spent a few laps of the lake mimicking different crews. I think we did, I can't remember if it was 250 meters or 500 meters, pretending to be the Romanian 8 or the Russian 8 or the Dutch 8. And you know, some people seem to sit at the back for half an hour before they rush forward and smack it in for the catch. And they seem to go quite fast. The way I was always taught was about making sure the hands go away at the speed they come out. And in order to do that when racing, sometimes at lower rates, you've got to do it faster. So, you know, how that fits for people who are learning to row in Romania? It probably doesn't. You know, Drew had a was clearly incredibly successful, and his thinking is slightly different. You know, I'm not in a position to say that, you know, he's right, I'm right, he's wrong, because he's won a lot more than me. He's just learned a different way to me.
Ben, there are plenty of personalities inside an eight. What do you think are the key preparations that a crew can make in terms of making sure that all their egos are set aside and that you're pushing together?
I think egos are really, really interesting. I can think of loads and loads of situations where ego comes first. So you do anything to prove that you're right, and you know, you dig your heels in, even when you know it's ridiculous, because you just want to show everybody else that you're right and they're wrong. And you're happy to let the boat go slower. You're happy to lose because of it. And I think that's really interesting. And I think that ego so often get in the way. You know, you need a certain amount of ego to believe that you're good enough to win and beat other people. But when it comes to working as a unit, I don't think it's that often useful. And helping people understand, get it kind of logically is one thing, but also most decisions are made emotionally. Getting people to really understand the impact of what they're doing, I think is really important. And, you know, what's more important, being right or winning? Being right might feel good at the time, but when it comes to crossing the finish line, would you rather have let somebody else got their way a few times rather than you dig your heels in?
That's really interesting. I was in a crew going to Ghent Regatta one time, and one of the girls in our quad wanted to race her single, but the race times clashed with the quad, and she was prepared to sacrifice the quad, which was going to be our main racing boat for the whole season, just in order that she could do the single. And it caused an incredibly tense moment in the crew's build-up.
I can think of a character in the run-up to one of the games that I competed at, one of the Olympics, who wanted to be in a different seat. So his way of showing that he was good enough to be in that seat was to get his blade in, you know, a blade early every single stroke. And for a couple of weeks, he kept this up just to show that he was, you know, he should be in a different seat. And it had a massive impact on the crew so that he could be right. And I'm not sure how much slower we went because of it, but it was pretty significant. And he completely stitched himself up and the rest of us through wanting to prove a point.
Really interesting. Of course, as a coach, it's incredibly difficult to know what you could do. What sort of options do you think face a coach when you've got a situation like that?
I think that, that on the whole, people do the best with what they know. So if they're making stupid decisions, you know, maybe if they knew a bit more, if they knew some different perspectives, then maybe they might do something different. And it's not just about logic. It's you've got to kind of really understand what the implications of things are. And so whether we take somebody to one side and talking to them about, you know, what things could be like, what things might be like if they were to change, if they were to stay the same, getting them to kind of run through different scenarios, getting them to try and understand the impact of what's happening. And I think also giving people room to, you know, get themselves out of situations they've got into.
That's quite interesting. So planning a possible exit route so that someone can exit with pride, if possibly not their point of view being acknowledged.
Absolutely. There's no point in backing. You know, so often it becomes a lot of discussions become confrontations because we're not willing to give way. And, you know, as a coach, if you want to change your athlete's views, is it about you being right or is it about getting the crew to go faster? In which case, you know, sometimes admitting that you're wrong just to give the other person scope to get out will make the boat go faster. So the key thing with all of these sorts of discussions has got to be about what's going to make the most difference to the boat speed, rather than am I right or am I wrong.
Going back to yourself as an athlete, did you ever have trouble with motivation or burnout, and what did you do to work through these points?
The national team does some things that are pretty successful around it, such as training camps. Going to a different place to train is, you have a bit of a different perspective, and it's a bit different, and it's a bit like a, you know, a bit of a break, although you normally do more training. Doing cross training, when we went on cycling camps, for the first few days or week or whatever, people would love it, would absolutely love it. You know, talk about when we cut this person up, when we made a break, when this happened. By the end of 2 or 3 weeks, people would be hating it, complaining about sore asses and hating it. And then you get back in a boat and you go, oh, this is amazing. I love rowing. And so being in different environments or doing cross training, I think, can really, really help. I think that also, I mean, I'm sure we all have days where we lack motivation, where we, whether it be because we've had a rubbish day or week or month, or whether it be because we're tired or because there's something else going on at home. I think we all have situations where we struggle with motivation. And for me, when I had a really, really clear picture in my head of what I was trying to achieve, I was most motivated. And when the picture faded, I was least motivated. So being able to kind of keep that picture really strong, no matter how tired I was really important.
Very interesting. For myself, I can say that definitely process goals are useful. Last night we had a squad session, we were all on the ergs, and I found my first piece was much worse than my second, but in my second piece I focused on reducing my average split, which of course over a long piece takes a long time to change the numbers, and I produced a much better score at the end of it just because I had a very small short-term goal.
I think breaking stuff down into small pieces is certainly makes kind of ergo sessions go faster. And it's simply the way to improve. If you're just going out, whether it be on the rowing machine or in the boat, just going out to do another session, whereas if you're going out to improve your hand speed, your movement off your feet, then you got something to do. And I completely agree. Process goals are really, really important.
The next question we've got from a viewer is, what's the cost to set up a Row Perfect, which Ben and I have already agreed he isn't going to answer. I'm going to answer this one. If you're in the UK, you can buy one for around £2,000. That includes VAT. Cost in terms of setting up is actually more your own investment of time in learning and experimenting with using the Row Perfect. See what it's like. See how your rowing looks on the screen and the force curve. As a coach, take a look at how an athlete moves and see how that's reflected in the force curve, and then make decisions about how to change their body movement in order to reflect the curve that you're looking for. A lot of that investment is just about your own motivation and skill in experimentation, in my view. Does anyone else, or whoever asked that question, have any particular supplementals they want to ask on that point before we move back towards Ben? Okay. We've got a question here from an athlete who says they've trained for almost every day for over 5 years. They've done camps, marathons, long distance races, and they've got one more race planned in a couple of weeks and then a big event in August. But the writer feels, I feel I can't stop, but I can't go on anymore. I feel like I was run over by a train. Should I stop, and will it help, or will I lose my strength?
I think it's difficult to comment on specific situations when I don't know the background. I mean, if you're going through part of the training cycle where you're supposed to feel as though you've been hit by a train, then you probably need to keep going. I always find this really, really hard. The sessions where, or the days or the weeks where I was absolutely on my knees, maybe feeling kind of rubbish, my kind of default mode for years was to think, oh, it's just because I'm soft, therefore I need to push myself harder, which more often than not, was not the right thing to do. And to actually be able to admit that, no, this is, it's not me being soft. I have had it and I do actually need to ease off, was I found really, really hard to do. But sometimes it's critical. I thought it was quite interesting. Quite a lot of the guys I rode with, when they came back from an injury and they'd been doing less training because of an injury, they'd come back and perform really, really well. A lot of them did personal bests, a few weeks after coming back, having done very little. I wonder whether sometimes in rowing we do too much training. I think if it's not part of your cycle, then you need to seriously work out, is it the best thing to actually give yourself a break? Because if you've done so much, then you're probably going to be pretty fit and maybe your body does need to recover.
I'd definitely echo that and say to that person that go speak to your coach, find out about the training cycles. If you don't have a coach, hire one to help you write a training program through to your big event in August. And certainly a rest after your event at the end of May would not impact in a serious amount your performance in August, because there's plenty of time, if you're already fit, as Ben has recommended, to take a break or just to ease off on your training for a few weeks before you start to build up to the new peak. Going back to you, Ben, how do you talk yourself through the discomfort and pain of a monotony of a hard session on the erg or the water?
On the erg, I normally spend my time doing maths. I'm not very good at mental arithmetic, so it took me a long time. I would always, if doing a 20K session, for example, I would constantly be working out what my average split time was going to be, end up looking like, how much I had to go to halfway, because all I had to do was go to halfway, because then the rest is downhill. So you don't need to worry about that. Until you get to halfway, you can then start counting down. But I'd only ever basically count up to halfway, and so I was constantly kind of doing maths essentially to try and work out exactly, was I an eighth, was I a ninth, was I a tenth of the way, where I was. Also, what we started doing was trying to make sure that those ergo sessions weren't boring. There was no monotony because we were really, really focusing on specific things.
This is technique you're talking about.
Absolutely. So really listening to the noise the machine made, looking at the force time curves, looking at how we were going to move our back. We would have a technical aim for every single ergo session, and the idea was to be thinking about that as hard as you possibly could, so that you would end up mentally as knackered as you were physically.
Did you did you self-score, give yourself points out of 10 for achieving that technical point?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did a few different things. Firstly, either Martin or Harry would be our coaches, would be in the room coaching and supporting. We had it was a fairly small room. We had kind of mirrors around so you could see what you were doing. We would always do the ergos in time with the rest of the crew, rowing the rhythm we wanted to row in the boat. And we had to be able to do that together in the boat, so therefore we had to do it together on the ergs. He had a video camera that hooked up to a TV that he could move around and kind of put at different angles so you could see yourself from all sorts of different angles as to what you were doing. And he coached us, and actually Rolly, our cox, coached us quite intensively. We would set ourselves goals essentially for each session of what we wanted to do. And at the end, yeah, absolutely, we'd score ourselves out of 10 as to how we had performed doing the bit we wanted to do. The score was pretty obvious, but if I wanted to improve the movement off my feet, then at the end I'd want to give myself a score of 1 to 10. How did I perform doing that?
So what was your favourite workout on the erg in the winter training pre-Olympics?
I quite enjoyed 20Ks. 20K, half UT1, half UT2, 2K on, 2K off. I quite enjoyed. Those were probably my best sessions. And I did quite well, so long as I had my music on, because we also always took it in turns with music. I like my music, not that anyone else did, but there we are.
That's funny.
I thought Shirley Bassey was just absolutely perfect for 20 Kyogos.
I'll put it down as a recommendation next time we're on the boat. Talking more about your coaches, how were you coached through the different phases of the stroke? And have you got any useful tips for technique training?
There are a few things we did. I mean, we obviously broke the cycle down into different parts. And then what we would often do, so if we were working on the catch for 10 days, maybe up to 2 weeks, we would talk about nothing but the catch. And the whole focus would be on that. And it would be so frustrating. You'd feel as though the rhythm was falling apart, the balance wasn't working, everything was, and we'd be trying to make big changes because, as I said earlier, trying to just make tiny changes doesn't work. So we try and make big changes, and then we might have to come back a bit, but that was fine. And everything would feel as though it's falling apart. And then when we had kind of had enough, absolutely had it, Martin would get us out, you know, playing word games or number games or word association or something up and down the boat to try and stop us thinking about rowing. And suddenly you'd realize that the boat was just running underneath you and your hands were flying up and the whole thing had come back together. So we broke it down and intensively looked at things. But while we were intensively looking at it on the water, we'd be doing the same thing on the ergos, in the weights room, with everything we did, it was trying to make sure that we were focusing on that part of the cycle.
Very interesting. Tell us about the word association. How did that work?
You know, 9, 20-something-year-old blokes, one person starts and you say a word, and then, you know, whatever word comes to your mind for the person who's sitting behind, and you can imagine where it went.
So it went all the way from cox to bow, and then did it roll back again or jump back to the cox?
Yeah, it rolled back. I went up and down the boat.
I guess there were some repetitive themes.
Yes. Yes, there might have only been one theme, I'm not sure.
Right, moving on swiftly, not safe for work. What's the best drill you know to achieve boat balance in a sweet boat? This person's asking specifically for a four.
There are a few exercises that I thought worked pretty well. I thought, firstly, and I know different people call exercises different things, so I'll try and explain what I mean. Roll ups, so where you start from the backstop position, and with your blades buried, and on the word go, you take your blade out and you just roll forward and you put the oars into the catch. That was quite good actually, as a setup. So you can work out, you've got two fixed points, the boat's not moving, you've got two fixed points, and you can do quite a lot to figure balance out on that. Really basics like single strokes I thought were really useful. Pausing in different places. I didn't think it was particularly useful to pause kind of further forward than about quarter slide, but pausing in various different places so you can fit, so again, you've got fixed points you can come back to. Another thing that whilst rowing continuously that gave you fixed points was a thing where you take the blade out, you go out kind of past your knees, and just past your knees, as your knees start to break, you then tap the handle on the sax boards before you then roll out and stick it in. And again, it gave you a fixed point where you knew everyone was doing exactly the same movement. And so I thought various different exercises, I say, with fixed points, you know where you start, where your finish is, gave you a chance to figure out the balance of different parts of the stroke.
That's fantastic, Ben. Certainly, I'd echo what you say about the pause paddling single strokes. One of the positions that very few people choose to pause in is actually at the finish with the blade resting on the water, because at that point your handle is obviously close to your chest and it gives every athlete the chance to find out whether they are actually drawing their blade to the correct height at the finish.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a key point. I think they're kind of hands away, then hands to body, then quarter slide, and the most useful places. Some people do it out to three-quarter slide, which frankly, I never really, it didn't really work for me, but That's just me.
What percentage of the time did you spend on catches and catch entry drills in the lead up to the Olympics?
Loads. And the catch entry was getting hand movement right was one thing, making sure our hands were lifting to go into the water right and combining it with the movement of the feet. The two bits were we spent a huge amount of time working on, hence what I said earlier about being really coordinated on my feet, walking, simple things like walking upstairs silently, all that sort of stuff. But we spent a huge amount of time because on the erg, it's pretty simple. You just generate positive numbers, essentially. In the boat, if you don't get the right coordination between your hands lifting and your feet changing direction, then you generate negative numbers. And we physically weren't as good as a lot of our opposition. We couldn't generate as big a positive number, so we had to absolutely minimize the negative numbers. And most of that minimizing you can do around the catch. So for us, it was critical.
It's really interesting you say that. I've had the opportunity in the past to speak to Martin McElroy about technique coaching. And he always says, you know, when you see a new crew, where do you start? And he said, for him, his instincts are nearly always to focus, as you said, on the negative numbers, on the recovery, making sure that how the crew moves in the recovery phase for him is usually a bigger learning point, and that's where he tends to start coaching.
Yep. Yeah, we spend a huge amount of time around the catch.
If you've got a mixture of tall and short people in a crew, where's the best place to focus to keep in rhythm?
I think making sure you're getting to, you know, hands just past the knees together is a pretty key point. And that's a pretty key place to, kind of on the recovery, it's a good kind of fixed point. You know, you want to be in time at the catch and at the finish, but actually using that midpoint when you're just about to let your knees up, I think that's got to be another point that you've got to make sure people are going through together.
Very interesting. Quick comment from the floor. Chris says, what percentage of the technical outings were you doing catch drills, or did you do them in every outing?
As part of the warm-up, we did. We did the kind of classic, a little bit of paddling in fours. When we went off the landing stage every time, a little bit of paddling in fours. And part of that was with outside arm only. And that was more about getting into the routine of hanging off the handle. We'd then build up the whole crew, kind of arms, body, legs, and kind of going out. And one of the key things about that was getting the change of direction at the front. So even when we were on just arms and body, the idea was to make sure the catch was going in really effectively and we were getting the change of direction really effectively then. So there were parts of the normal warm-up routine that we did that were absolutely focused on catch and getting that right. In terms of the percentage of technical sessions we did working on the catch, I'm not sure, probably a fairly high percent, but I'm not sure what it would have been. Certainly more than 50%, but exactly what it was, I'm not sure.
So Ben, big question now, how many Weetabix did you have before a big race?
My normal thing was eight every morning.
Eight?
Before a big race, probably not that many because I just peek them up anyway.
Before a big race.
Sorry?
Were you known for that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, when the boys saw me hurling, they'd kind of slap me on the back and say, you know, at least he's up for it. I never puked after training or racing, it was always before. So before a big race, I ate a bit, but there was no point in forcing too much down because it just meant more was going to come up.
And was this something that happened to you throughout your rowing career? Or?
I went through phases. I managed to kind of have a few years in the middle where I didn't puke too much, but yeah, it was a kind of, you know, theme that went through quite a lot of my career.
And obviously it hasn't stayed with you once you've stopped rowing.
I've had all sorts of situations where I've been nervous and stuff, but never so nervous that I wanted to puke, no.
So no pre-wedding nerves, obviously.
No. I didn't have to. I was going to say I didn't have to perform then, but you know what I mean.
Now, last question from us is: who was Basil?
Who was Basil?
You might need to explain the context of this.
Yeah. So we had a. The reason people probably know about Basil is from in my book. I've kind of got a chapter about, well, a bit of the book about don't talk bollocks to Basil, and we had. I'm not actually sure where the saying came from, but I thought it was Fred from Oxford Brookes who brought it in, but he kind of denies it. The saying was, don't talk bollocks to Basil. And it's easy to get caught up kind of talking about stuff that's just kind of completely irrelevant, to bring other people into what we're doing, to waste our time on other people, and waste our time talking to or listening to other people. We talked about having bullshit filters as well, where the kind of these invisible ear defenders, and you can whack them up to maximum deflection. And we were really clear on what we were trying to do as a crew. We were clear on what we had to do, how we had to do it, why we were doing it, and other people's opinions, just frankly, in a lot of cases, wasn't that interesting. Listening to what the press thought of us, really, who cares? You know, we just weren't interested in their opinion. So we would kind of whack these things up to maximum deflection, and, you know, Basil's views wouldn't get through. There were people in the team who I had massive, massive respect for, who were friends, but who weren't part of what we were doing. And their views, frankly, you know, they were just Basil's, and I just had to block them out because it just wasn't useful. So all sorts of people took on the kind of Basil role at different times, where I just, you know, wasn't interested in their opinion, wouldn't listen to it, I absolutely not trying to be rude to people, either avoiding conversations or, you know, nodding my head vigorously while inside thinking I'm not listening, and just getting into conversations about stuff that didn't involve them, that, you know, where their opinions weren't interesting, we try to avoid. So that was lots and lots of different people could be Basil.
Very interesting. Thank you for that. I'd always thought it was Basil Fawlty, but clearly I'm wrong.
Him as well at times, maybe.
I've got a question from John in Oxford, who says, there are various versions of what was said to your crew before the Sydney repechage, or between the rep and the final, to do with the distinction between looking good and racing hard. What was the truth about that story?
I can't tell you word for word, but essentially we came off the water after the heat, having lost to the Australian 8 by 1.6 seconds, I think it was. We had rode diabolically. We had essentially gone out there trying to row really nicely, rather than actually sticking it in and giving it some welly. And Harry Mann said something along the lines, if we wanted to do dressage, we should F off to the equestrian centre and do dressage, whereas if we wanted to race, we should hang around here and start to work hard. And no one disagreed with him.
So it was exactly the right motivation at the right time.
Yeah, we're just in the run up to the heat. We had got nervous. We'd stopped talking to each other, and we were, you know, working really hard on rowing nicely, forgetting that the key thing that moves the boat is a bit of oomph, and we messed up, but that was fine. We had time to put it right.
Another question from John was, what's the health of the sport of rowing now and its dependency on volunteers?
I think my view of rowing is fairly narrow in many ways. I've you know, from rowing in a private school to going to Leander, you know, the national team, and now the, you know, I'm involved with Henley and I'm involved with World Cups. You know, I don't see much of the grassroots. So what's the from where I am, the health of the sport looks pretty good. I mean, we've got a phenomenally successful team. The number of people who volunteered for the World Cup was absolutely incredible, and we had to turn away a lot of people because we had far too many people volunteering for roles to fill. I think there are I think there are a few things that are pretty hard. I think that kind of 30, in your 30s or 40s, when you're probably really trying to get your career going, you've got a family, I think a huge number of people give up the sport at that point, which, and it would be good to find a way of keeping more people involved. I think that a lot of club committees are really struggling for volunteers. It seems though for events, getting volunteers like a World Cup is, a lot of people want to do it, but for the day-to-day, getting clubs and I think kind of more kind of local events working, getting volunteers is pretty hard. People are incredibly busy, and so I think from that respect, I think it's pretty difficult. But I think that a lot of sports in the UK are in a very similar position. Sport will always be run by volunteers. It always will. We might get some more paid people, but most of the work will have to be done by volunteers, and we need to find a way of keeping people involved. And for the everyday stuff, making sure we have got a volunteer group of different age ranges.
It's interesting that you say that. Certainly my own experiences in particularly trying to get volunteer coaches is that the one of the better ways of doing it is to split the job up into many smaller components than previously. So instead of having one coach for a squad, in fact, to have several coaches so that no one person has to get up and do all the early mornings or all the Saturdays and all the Sundays. And although it might mean that there's some lack of consistency, it means that there is supervision, particularly for juniors, which was where I was coaching, and you couldn't let them row on their own. And that helped, particularly when we got parents involved, even if they'd not been rowers before. We taught them how to drive launches and be safety support, for example.
Yeah, and I think with youngsters, getting parents involved is a really, really important thing to do. I think some clubs with smaller junior elements probably find it pretty hard.
It's interesting you say that. It's not actually as hard as you think. Most clubs are somewhere near a tertiary education institute where there are people who row. And we found a great solution was to price the junior membership such that we could put aside enough money from each session to pay a coach. We were only paying, I think, £15 an hour, or might even have been £15 a session. And because junior sessions can be very short, like they're 45 minutes, an hour max, we would get a student to come and coach, and we'd pay for them to go through their level two coaching course at the club's expense. But then the quid pro quo was their commitment to coach for a term at a time, doing two sessions on a Saturday and two on a Sunday after they'd done their own training. So they had beer money, effectively, for their weekend. And we had a responsible adult who knew about rowing, able and willing to coach the juniors because they were being paid. And this made a really useful balance, because we actually found that we had too many kids for the available coaches. And this enabled us to expand the coaching team, and it was entirely paid for by the additional memberships, subscriptions from the kids.
That sounds like a really, really clever way of doing it.
John, a nice bit of feedback here for you, Ben. He's really enjoying your considered opinion on such a wide range of questions.
Good. Well, it's just my opinion, so don't take it too much to heart.
Right, moving on. First thing we'd like to say to everybody who's here, if you haven't already got it, Row Perfect's got an offer on to buy Ben's book with the two Harry Mann rowing technique DVDs. We've only put it on sale this week for a special, and it's going to last through to Sunday. So if you want it, go grab it now. It's in the Row Perfect shop under DVDs, and it's a bundle offer that Ben has very kindly agreed to sell us his book to add to the bundle at a great discounted price. If you only want the book, please go to Amazon, because they can supply it at a fantastic price that it's reasonably difficult for other retailers to match. Ben, I'd like to wrap up with a final bit about what you're doing now. Tell us about how you've moved on from being an active professional athlete into your new career.
Well, I've been doing corporate development work for the last, basically since I stopped rowing. Working for a training company, then running my own business, and I've set up with somebody else in the last few months. And what we're trying to do is really, really simple. We're trying to help people focus on what's important, focus on performance, they can actually get better, and then getting help from other people. And it seems as though so many of us are really, really busy doing what's in front of us rather than doing the stuff that really makes a difference. And we got a really kind of simple, the thinking behind it is really, really simple, but we know in reality doing it is harder. So we've got a program that runs over a number of weeks so we can really help and support people go through change and get the results they want to get. So help them clarify their direction, how to challenge to make sure they're constantly making their boat go faster, and how to get support doing it.
Now, you've set up a free course for people. Tell us how they can get hold of it.
I've got a free e-course, which is kind of gives kind of a number of exercises or questions to challenge yourself around to help you kind of in these areas. I would say download it from my website, but unfortunately, for some reason, it crashed a couple of days ago and I haven't got it up yet. So if you want to have a look at it, then if you email me at info@willitmakethebotgofaster.com. It's really short and catchy. info@willitmakethebotgofaster.com. Then I can get it sent out to you. And there are kind of a number of emails with some exercises to really help you make your boats go faster.
Fantastic. Flicking back again, we've got a question in from Graham. He says, I worry when I'm setting goals for my crews that if they fail, they'll be turned off from the process of goal setting. What are your thoughts?
I think that if a crew doesn't have a goal, what are they trying to do? Even whether the goal is, if it's recreational rowers, to make sure that they have more fun. I think there are all sorts of different goals that can be set. And if we don't achieve them, then there's, we can always look at, why is that? Was it, what are the reasons behind it? How can we have more chance of success next time? And I think having some goals that are within reach is important, but also some goals where, being realistic, that they're kind of your crazy goals that are aspirational, that are hard to get. And if I think people know they're hard to get and they are aspirational, then I think very often people are willing to keep plugging away, but you've got to make sure you're recognizing success as you go along. If you set a goal that people don't achieve, but they feel as though they performed really well along the way, and performance and results are different. So there are races I won where I performed really badly and was disappointed with the way I performed, and there are races I lost where I rode brilliantly. And yeah, I was gutted about having lost, but I knew that I performed really, really well, and that was really important. So I think making sure that you're focusing on both and people are recognizing the successes they have along the way is really, really important.
That's a great analogy. I have a recollection of a race where I rode brilliantly, which was the Sculler's Head one year, and I'd just overtaken a girl under Hammersmith Bridge who'd been to the Commonwealth and was feeling reasonably pleased with myself, at which point I turned round to check my course and the wind caught me and my contact lens dropped out of my eye and sat on my left cheek. And I'm sitting there rowing along thinking, that's £70 sitting on my cheek. Do I stop for one stroke to try and pick it up and put it somewhere where I'll be able to get it after the race? and risk losing my rhythm and having this girl overtake me again. And I struggled with this and eventually decided it was much more important to forfeit £70 and keep on rowing. John, go on, sorry.
I was going to say, I think probably the best race I had at Henley, I lost the grand every time I entered. I lost every race I ever did in the grand. But there was one race where we performed, it was the best performance we did all year. And I was gutted at having lost the grand again, but the kind of satisfaction of knowing that we had absolutely nailed it with everything we could was great.
Which brings us nicely to John's question, saying, what does SMART stand for?
SMART goals. Specific, measurable, achievable, realistic and timely, or something like that. There are all sorts of different variations. If you put SMART into Google Images, you come up with about 75 different ideas of what the letters stand for. But I think having some SMART goals is really important, so you can measure how you're doing, so you know when you're supposed to achieve it, I think is really important. But also having some crazy goals, some aspirational things, because SMART goals are very seldom that inspirational, I don't think. So, yeah, there are lots of things that, yeah, depending on what you look at, it stands for different things, and they're useful, but I don't think you should get carried away by them.
There's a very interesting comment which is often quoted of Steve Jobs, which is, he says, people usually overestimate what they can do in 1 year, but underestimate what they can do in 10 years. And certainly for an endurance sport like rowing, whether you're being a coach or an athlete, I think that is definitely something we can take to heart.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
Right, any final questions from viewers? Listeners, John says he kind of knew the answer to the SMART question, but he thought it was relevant in the context of what the previous question was from Graham about goal setting.
Absolutely relevant.
So, just to wrap up, I've put a little link into the text chat. This is the SoundCloud account that Row Perfect has created for anyone who might want to listen after today and to listen to other rowing chats that we've done. We will be uploading them later, and we will be sending that through to you in a link after the event, so that you can get it for yourself. And if you want to listen again or share it with anyone else who's on your team, that will be absolutely brilliant. We're looking, apparently there's one more question has just come through. Chris George, no questions. Many thanks and good luck at the World Cup. Thanks from Graham and thanks from me to Ben. It's been absolutely brilliant having you on here. Please, everybody, go sign yourself up for Ben's free e-course. And we very much look forward to inviting you all to the next rowing chat, which will be in 4 weeks' time. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you very much. And I look forward to seeing as many of you as possible at the World Cup.
It looks like quite a few people are going to be there.
Brilliant.
It's going to be a fantastic show.